Matthew, thank you for coming in, and we look forward to your presentation.
All right, well, thank you for the opportunity to present here today. I might, just before I start, I think you probably received copies of these previously, but I just took some copies.
Okay.
They're a very good short summary document, but anyone else can have them. There's plenty of copies. Thank you very much. It's just a very short, it was our state election policy manifesto that we issued during the recent state election campaign. It's a very good summary document of our position on the critical issues as we see them for same-sex couples. Welcome to the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission to South Australia, the discrimination state. The only Australian state or territory that does not offer broad-based legislative recognition to same-sex couples and denies them access to the legal rights, protections and benefits married couples and other de facto couples enjoy. While same-sex couples welcome the Commission's initiative in conducting public consultation on this issue, a very important issue and an excellent initiative, it is a shame that once again we have to sit before yet another inquiry to find out what we all already know. To my knowledge, this is the 15th public inquiry into recognition of same-sex couples in Australia, and still our politicians here and federally fail to act. Around the world, 35 countries now offer some form of legislative recognition to same-sex couples, and the list is growing. That's the light green is an illustration of countries where laws to recognise same-sex couples have been proposed and are under some degree of consideration, in some cases more active than others. The dark green is countries where there is a scheme of recognition for same-sex couples currently in some form, whether it be de facto, registration or marriage, and in some cases multiple forms of those. Federal discrimination against same-sex couples here in Australia is quite obviously out of step with trends in many comparable countries. We just heard in the last 24 hours that South Africa is about to legislate to give same-sex marriage. Their High Court had already previously held that it was unconstitutional to not do so. And here in South Australia, the failure to recognise same-sex couples in state laws means we're even further behind the rest of the country. South Australia has long been a pace setter in social reform. Known as the paradise of dissent, we were a colony unusually established on the basis of complete religious freedom. We were an early colonial example of Australian multiculturalism, with a substantial German refugee population from Silesia. The first state to offer the vote for women, commemorated here in the Women's Suffrage Tapestry from State Parliament. A pioneer in Aboriginal land rights, the first to introduce sex discrimination laws in Australia, and, coincidentally, the first to offer legislative recognition for de facto couples. And once we set the pace on gay law reform too. It's a little bit blurred, but we know who he is. 30 years ago, we led the nation and much of the world in decriminalising homosexuality. And a decade later, we built on this success by becoming the first state to introduce laws banning discrimination based on sexuality. However, now, South Australia holds the wooden spoon when it comes to gay rights. Even federal laws, many of which discriminate against same-sex couples and fall short of social expectations and accepted human rights standards, provide recognition for same-sex couples more broadly than the South Australian statute book. To my knowledge, same-sex couples are afforded federal recognition directly in anti-terrorism laws and indirectly in immigration and some superannuation laws. So the feds have actually done more than South Australia has in this respect. So, unlike same-sex couples in the rest of the country, if you're gay or lesbian and live in South Australia, you'll not only experience discrimination under federal laws such as Medicare, but also under state laws across a wide range of areas. For instance, in South Australia, I'd be required to pay hefty stamp duty fees if I wish to transfer my house into joint names with my same-sex partner. Not so elsewhere. Or, I found this is an interesting example, because it shows how odd the examples are sometimes under the law. If I had a water irrigation licence for the Murray River, under the Water Resources Act, and these licences can often be worth millions of dollars, incidentally, under the Water Resources Act, as it currently stands, I'd be unable to pass that licence on to my same-sex partner in the event of my death. Not so if I was in a heterosexual relationship. So you can see that these are quite significant bits and pieces, and combined together, they form a mosaic of systemic discrimination that is ever-present in the lives of same-sex couples. And I won't bore you by going through all the examples, but obviously there's, many of them are presented in the papers that have been provided to you. Suffice to say, the Let's Get Equal campaign, over the 5 years that we've been on operation, has heard many real stories of discrimination and disadvantage resulting from the current federal and state laws. Many of these are documented in our submission papers. Our social fabric is built upon loving, committed relationships. And our law has long recognised this by granting a range of rights, benefits, protections and responsibilities for people in those relationships, including married and unmarried couples. But not so for same-sex couples, as we know, no matter how long, how stable, how evidently mutually dependent and loving they are. So why are we dragging our heels when it comes to recognition of this fundamental injustice? Brokeback Mountain. Some of you may have seen it. No doubt most of you have heard of it. A box office success and a beautiful love story. Set in the most average of settings, it showed a passionate love that anyone could understand, and what it was subjected to because it happened to be between two men. To me, this story in many ways illustrates the essence of what discrimination against same-sex couples is all about. Because who you love, who you form your relationships with, is a core part of who you are. It's part of your identity. To deny recognition of that identity is to deny a person their fundamental right as a human to happiness, freedom, and respect. And too few politicians are willing to stand up for principle on this issue. Too many are cowed by the vocal threats of a minority of opponents. We've had to stand on the steps of Parliament several times to remind them that we are still waiting for this legislation to be passed. But homosexuality is a political football, and here in South Australia we've had to see laws change across the country while current and previous state governments have dragged their heels. How painful it is to see some jurisdictions debating civil unions when we haven't even got off the ground on recognition as de factos. South Australian same-sex couples have been fighting for equal rights for a decade now. The first time an amendment was moved in Parliament was in 1996 on this issue. And sometimes we seem no closer to reaching our goal. In the last Parliament, a small number of politicians took advantage of the lack of ticker on the government side to sideline, again and again, debate on this issue. The only very limited change was a result of years of effort by a private members' bill. That gives you an idea of how low the priority on this issue has been in some quarters. So when, after public consultation in 2003, the government introduced its Relationships Bill in 2004, amending over 90 state laws, political games regrettably were played and it was ultimately sent to a parliamentary committee for inquiry. No doubt opponents of the bill thought this would kill the issue off. But instead, an exhaustive six-month inquiry into the legislation and its ramifications was undertaken, and a 169-page report tabled earlier than expected in mid-2005. Let me pay tribute to the efforts of those inquiry members who ensured it was undertaken without the usual delays. I won't mention those inquiry members who didn't. The inquiry heard 37 witnesses and received 2,300 written submissions. This is pretty unprecedented for a state parliamentary inquiry in South Australia. 57% of those submissions were in favour of the legislation. The report details the nature and breadth of discrimination against same-sex couples under state laws and summarises the arguments for and against the bill, and ultimately the recommendations of the inquiry that the bill should be supported with some amendments. I'd certainly encourage you all to read it. It provides a very comprehensive example. And there's some quotes from the committee's findings, which are pretty unequivocal. Following the early tabling of this report, the bill was at last reintroduced with the amendments responding to the inquiry's findings. But there were only a few months of parliamentary sittings left. Debate was prolonged, but eventually it passed the state upper house by 14 votes to 7, a two-thirds majority. A majority which, to my mind, indicates that those who say this is controversial, and there was someone last week who was saying exactly that, are way off the mark. But time was running out. With only 8 sitting days left, the bill languished in the lower house. Despite an evident majority in favour, and we know there was an evident majority in favour because the lower house passed the private members legislation previously by a clear majority, filibustering by the most trenchant opponents, many of them no longer in Parliament, fortunately, combined with a lack of political will by the government, meant the issue was not resolved before Parliament rose for the state election. It was sad and traumatic for us all when, with 100 supporters of the bill packing the public gallery, and there are several people here today who were there, the House adjourned debate for the last time. It really was it had to be one of the most gut-wrenching moments I've had in my life to see the House of Cards sort of tumble, I suppose. And so, as a consequence of this, recognising same-sex couples became an election issue. I've given you copies, as I said before, of our election manifesto, which details the policy that we put out there during the election as a lobby group. Suffice to say that the election saw the defeat of several of the most consistent opponents of the legislation and the vindication of those who stood by it. Marginal seat polling, which we conducted during the campaign, revealed 79% support for the legislation in a marginal seat which was being targeted, incidentally, by opponents of the legislation and some church groups. Even, and this 79%, I should point out, was even among those whose religious convictions, we are often told by our opponents, should lead us to believe otherwise, suggests to me, of course, that religion is not as monolithic as people like to portray it as sometimes. You'd be aware, though, from the recent media reports that there has been some controversy about the delays in returning this important bill to the Parliament. The government has now made it clear that in accordance with its election promise to the gay community, which a copy of which is published on our website, the bill will be reintroduced in the budget session of State Parliament, which begins tomorrow. 3 non-government MPs have indicated that if there are further delays, however, they will reintroduce it themselves. One way or other, the bill is at last back on the agenda, so we do expect to see it debated in the forthcoming parliamentary sittings. So, if Parliament passes this bill, what will it do? Well, it will give South Australian same-sex couples the same rights as other de facto partners in over 90 state laws, covering issues like inheritance, superannuation, property division in the event of a relationship breakdown, funerals and organ donation, consent to medical treatment, carer's leave, stamp duty, and many other topics. The proposed definition of a de facto partner is similar to that adopted in most states and territories and includes a cohabitation period of 3 years. Resulting from debate in the upper house, the bill also includes the ability for codependent partners, a new statutory category of relationship, to enter into relationship agreements without having to meet the cohabitation period for de facto couples. Same-sex couples who have not met the cohabitation requirements of the de facto definition may be able to avail themselves of this provision. The definition is based around the idea of dependency, and arguably if you're in a same-sex relationship you would meet that definition, or indeed if you're in a de facto heterosexual relationship. But it is broad enough to cover relationships of a non-sexual character, which was its intent. What the bill doesn't include, however, is equal rights for same-sex partners who are or wish to become parents. Adoption and access to reproductive technologies are excluded from the bill, and no provision is made allowing a same-sex partner to be named as a parent on a child's birth certificate. Heterosexual de facto partners are covered by these laws already in South Australia, but same-sex couples and their children will not be under this bill. Discrimination in these areas is, in my submission, not only contrary to the human rights of same-sex couples, but also contrary to the best interests of their children. You know, if we're talking about being named on a birth certificate, for instance, when we talk about parenthood, we talk about the legal, social and biological reality of parenthood. And the legal construct is that we try to recognise the social parents, in other words, the actual parents of the child. And so statutory provisions which relate to presumptions for parenting where it has involved an assisted reproductive process usually are set up to exclude a sperm donor or an egg donor from that process, as from the legal process as a legal parent. Not so for same-sex couples. They have to go through a much more artificial process, and that doesn't guarantee them anything, usually. It should, of course, be pointed out also that federal laws have banned overseas adoption by same-sex couples. I'm sure you're aware of that. So any changes to state adoption laws would need federal and state cooperation, ultimately. Although in practice, access to overseas adoption by same-sex couples is also limited by the country of origin's own laws, so I don't see that as a major issue, and certainly not an obstacle to changing the state legislation in any event. The bill also misses out including access for same-sex couples to the Federal Family Court in the case of relationship disputes. While states have been willing to refer this power to the federal government, and I think the standing committees of attorneys general, had agreed to do so some time ago, they have been met by a distinct lack of interest in Canberra. This means that same-sex couples undergoing relationship breakdown potentially have to go through two different court systems if dependent children are involved, rather than a single court that specialises in relationships and families. I think the federal government clearly needs to change its attitude on this one. It's just mean-spirited and has no logic to it. The bill also doesn't include civil unions or partnership registration, although, as I mentioned, this relationships agreement process may provide some opportunities for an agreement process to have recognition. This is a significant missing piece, however, that has both practical and symbolic impact. And this is one of the recent rallies which were protesting against the overturn of the ACT Civil Unions Bill. Access to legal arrangements that avoid uncertainty in how same-sex relationships are legally recognised is very important. De facto relationships legislation is all well and good, but as presumptive laws, they're only a safety net. They don't operate prospectively, but come into effect after the event. That is, once a dispute about a person's status has already commenced. A civil union or partnership registration scheme offers peace of mind because it enables same-sex couples to enter into a legally recognised relationship without having to worry about court cases later on. It also means that same-sex couples would be able, like their heterosexual counterparts, to take a shortcut from the minimum cohabitation requirements contained in most de facto definitions. Sometimes civil unions are criticised as being marriage light, a way of relegating same-sex couples to the status of second-class citizens. Symbolically, although civil unions don't carry the same social cachet as marriage, the sense of validation and legitimacy that arises from a formalised and state-sanctioned ceremony cannot be underestimated. In the absence of same-sex marriage, a civil union scheme, nationally developed or implemented on a state-by-state basis with mutual recognition, would at least mitigate the inability of same-sex couples to marry. I should say, I heard an interesting story at a conference I went to on this issue about the symbolic value of recognition. It was a paper presented at the Feminist Legal Academics Workshop a couple of years ago by Dr. Erin Cale from the University of Newcastle, and she'd done some research into the recent New South Wales same-sex relationships, property relationships bill, which of course was really the first cab off the rank in terms of a comprehensive suite of changes to the law. And one of the things that amusing little anecdote she had to share was that, you know, people in their commitment ceremonies, and we know commitment ceremonies have no force of law as such, but people in their commitment ceremonies were sometimes bringing along a copy of the Property Relationships Act and sort of swearing underneath it, this kind of thing. So, I mean, that's an amusing anecdote, but it actually does demonstrate, I think, what same-sex couples who are going through processes like commitment ceremony are seeking. They're seeking some kind of societal recognition that their relationship exists and that it is worthy of being of existence. Anyway, moving on. Of course, the bill doesn't cover same-sex marriage. Constitutionally, it probably can't, although I gather there's some debate about that. One day, I trust, this nation will have the guts to recognise that giving same-sex couples the right to celebrate their love by marrying can only strengthen our society. It's a refinement of cruelty to deny same-sex couples rights that all other couples enjoy merely because of the sexuality of their partners. And it is important to recognise that the continuing denial of these rights is not just a question of legal practicalities for same-sex couples, but also a question of our society's fundamental values. Are we a society based on fairness and acceptance of diversity, or are we a society based on division and fear of the unknown? I thought you'd find it interesting to hear some of the words of support for same-sex couples that have come from unexpected quarters in the last few years. Here's what the Catholic Archbishop of Adelaide said in supporting the state government's relationships bill. This was in his submission to the parliamentary inquiry. "We recognise the fact that people in our society need to be given opportunity to live out the human realities of their relationships," note that word, realities, "in a way which is protected by the law." I think it's quite remarkable that the Catholic Archbishop came and said those words, and we certainly welcomed them at the time. Even the Prime Minister has agreed that same-sex couples shouldn't be discriminated against in legislation. Of course, he says that, but he hasn't done very much to address it. And though he stopped short of supporting civil unions or same-sex marriage, quotes like this one are worthy of reminding people of. He can't argue against a bill which recognises same-sex couples at least as de facto, as I wouldn't have thought. And our State Attorney General, a man known for his strong personal religious convictions, is the author of the state bill and wholeheartedly supportive of it. While many same-sex couples are suspicious of where he's coming from, not without justification, his carefully chosen words in Parliament are hard to misinterpret, and these are the words he gave in his second reading speech to the bill last year. Both he and the Premier have now said several times the bill will now pass this year and that it will be introduced in the budget session forthcoming. Of course, the election has been and gone. State Parliament resumed in May, it's now August, and our elected representatives are sitting on North Terrace, having enjoyed their winter recess. Despite little to do during the first 22 sitting days already passed this year, yes, that's right, they've had 22 sitting days, we're still not certain when the government, which now has a substantial majority in the lower house, intends to get on with the job of reintroducing this legislation. With only 19 sitting days left this year and a state budget to consider, amongst other things, the clock is ticking. Meanwhile, federally, we hear about the possibility of a private members bill to give same-sex couples de facto rights in federal law. We've even heard about a possible national civil union scheme. With a recent bout of conscience vote in the federal parliament, it's not fanciful to imagine there could even be majority support at the end of the day for this private members bill. So, who will make it first? Will it be Canberra? Or will North Terrace pull out its finger and finish the job it began last year? I hope so. I think it would be really embarrassing and outrageous for South Australia to find itself in such a predicament. So, why is recognising same-sex relationships so important? How is recognising same-sex relationships a question of fundamental human rights? It's not just about an individual's right to liberty. It's not just about fair treatment and equality of opportunity. It's not just about the ability of all citizens to participate in society on the same footing. It's about the most fundamental right, I believe, that all human beings in a fair and decent society must have, the right to be accepted and respected for who they are. Without this foundation, no person can be said to be in possession of their dignity as a human being. And until our politicians realise this, they'll be complicit in every instance of prejudice, hostility and alienation that gay and lesbians experience. Happiness and life demands that we accept ourselves and that others accept us as well. Thank you very much.
Matthew, thank you very much for that presentation. let us keep our fingers crossed about the state government.
As I understand the submission that you made to us before, you're advocating both a civil union system of some sort and a registration system of some sort.
That's right.
Were you seeing the two operating in parallel?
Yes, potentially. I accept the political realities that what will probably happen is one will be chosen. But I think the basic, the fundamental difference between the model that the ACT proposed and the model that has been picked up in Tasmania is not about the legal nature of that relationship. Once it's entered into, it becomes recognised for the purposes of all these other laws. The fundamental difference is just simply the process about how you do it. The registration scheme requires that you sign a certificate, that you have a lawyer's certificate and a cooling off period, and once you've gone through that process and registered, you're done. The civil union scheme allows you to do that with a civil union celebrant and through some kind of process. All I'm suggesting is, why force people to choose one or the other? Why not provide both options? It seems to me that people who want to just simply go in and fill out a form and have it appropriately notarised with a legal practitioner's certificate, that's fine. But people who want to actually have a formal ceremony where the celebrant is actually an authorised celebrant for the purposes of the law, I think they should be able to do that as well. I don't think we should be excluding either option. It doesn't seem to me that it's necessary to do so.
Are you going to have a third option as well, a sort of cohabitation period that will operate even if people don't want to go and do either of those formal things?
Yes. I think it's absolutely critical that you have to have a safety net presumptive scheme, because some of the laws in relation to de facto couples relate to disputes or inequalities between the partners, obviously, similar to some of our family laws federally. But also, the recognition of de facto couples is also important for children in those relationships. And also, we have to accept the reality that many people choose not to have their relationship go through formal steps in their relationship, and they shouldn't find themselves in bother or difficulty because of that. And sometimes that happens because people just take a long time to plan their affairs. Sometimes it happens because they actually have a philosophical objection to going through that kind of process. I know two heterosexual couples. One's a lawyer. One is a couple of they're two lawyers, and they have made quite a deliberate decision after, I don't know, 12 years together or something like that, to not get married and not do anything else other than just be a de facto. They don't believe in it. That's their principled position, and they know that the law affords them a degree of recognition in any event as a de facto, because they've been together with that period and they also have children. I know another couple who have no children. They've been together for about 8 years, so they'd be picked up under de facto laws. But in their case, it's simply the reason that they haven't got married is because they've been planning it forever, and they just, you know, they just haven't gotten around to it. So, you know, the law should be able to fluid enough and flexible enough to be able to recognise those types of situations. In terms of the cohabitation period, I should say I know that there is some variance in cohabitation periods across jurisdictions. South Australia currently has 5 years. I think that's probably a bit of a historical anachronism, because South Australia introduced the concept of a putative spouse, which is the term we currently use in our law to recognise de facto partners, in 1975. So we were really... coincidentally, that was the year we decriminalised homosexuality. So we were a bit of a pace setter in that area. Another one of those social reforms under the belt. But that legislation hasn't really been updated for that time, and I think that generally society accepts that 5 years is a very long time to have to be together before you get any recognition on the law. So we lobbied very strongly the government to reduce that cohabitation period, and they have done so to 3 in the bill they proposed. I think that's still more than in some jurisdictions. I think most of the Eastern Seaboard it's 2 years, and in some cases there's no mention of a cohabitation period per se. It's just merely one of the indicators that a court can have regard to in determining whether the de facto relationship is in existence. I think if you have a cohabitation period, that increases the legal practicality, obviously, of having a registration / civil unions type proposal. But even without a mandatory cohabitation period, there are still good legal reasons why, and practical reasons, as well as symbolic reasons, why those options should be on the table.
I infer from that you think 3 years is probably a bit too long.
I think 3 years probably is a bit too long, but I accept that in the case of South Australian law, it's probably a question of incrementalism. We only speak on behalf of same-sex couples, so while we may have a view on it, it's a sort of it's a broader policy question. And there were some views put to me from people I spoke to in the government at the time that. Well, this bill is about equalising the equal rights of same-sex couples. It's not about changing de facto laws overall. So I think they weren't in the mood to necessarily bite off more than they could chew. So 3 years was probably the best we were going to get out of them in that respect. But yes, I do think 3 years is still actually rather long. I actually think that the idea of having no cohabitation period mandated is probably quite reasonable. It's a presumptive system, so court is perfectly able to make a judgment as to whether the cohabitation is indicative that this is a de facto relationship that should be recognised.
Quite a different topic. You mentioned the water licences. Which act is that under?
The Water Resources Act. Yes, there's a whole heap of acts, and I'll tell you how I found this one out. I was at a function. We have an organisation here in South Australia, you might be aware of it, the Governor's Leadership Foundation, and they do a sort of a courses every year under the patronage of the Governor, and it's sort of a course where they take people through a whole range of issues. It's a management course, really, essentially. It's quite a civic-minded course, and one of the topics that they present to their participants, so you get people from business, from government, from the community sector coming along to these things. One of the sessions they presented is a session on equity and fairness, and they have invited us to speak there for the last 3 or 4 years on equity and fairness and issues for the gay community and same-sex couples. And I was I went to the dinner afterwards after presenting to them, and I was chatting with one of the people here who happened to work in primary industries, and he said to me, yes, I was very surprised when I saw the list of legislation that was being amended, because, of course, you know, cabinet consultation processes within government, what happens is every department that has a bill which is administered, which is being amended by this one, has to look at it. And he said, I had to look at it, and I was thinking, how does the Water Resources Act discriminate? And he looked it up, and so he told me this. And he told me the practical effect that a water licence is, you know, on the Murray River, a water licence is your living. Don't have a water licence or an irrigation licence. A lot of those acts, are conflict of interest type provisions. So, like, for instance, in the Local Government Act, they're conflict of interest provisions. So those are actually responsibilities. And I think it's one of the things I try to stress a lot, and I think I stressed it, if I remember, in our submission to the Social Development Committee of the Parliament, was that same-sex couples in South Australia are perfectly willing to accept the responsibilities as well as the rights. We don't have a problem with that. Don't have a problem with that at all. Because we see the rights and the validation that comes from having that recognition as being much more important.
You mentioned that the proposed legislation won't pick up adoption, reproductive technology and birth certificates.
Yes.
Are you proposing to continue advocating for those ones to be included?
Yes. We accept that it may be difficult to include them in this bill. The government's made its policy or political decision not to include them. But we haven't written the thing off the agenda at all. We have an active subgroup of the Let's Get Equal campaign working on these issues. We're in dialogue with the health department, people who are responsible for the Reproductive Technology Act part of it, and we're conducting some research on the topic. In terms of adoption, there are two issues with adoption. One is what you might call co-adoption, or what is commonly referred to as step-parent adoption, and the other is stranger adoption. It is easier for us to argue about the co-adoption issue, because what that is about a same-sex partner being able to become the legally recognised parent of their partner's children. If they're under their joint care. And look, there are many examples of that. Of course, people can go to the family court and get a consent order. But, of course, consent orders can always be subject to challenge. It's an order of the court, so it's not ironclad in the same way that an adoption process would be. So we're certainly advocating for them. We've got some interest, certainly, in the co-adoption issue. In the longer term, I suspect it'll be a few more years before we can get those issues right back in the agenda. It's probable we will have to see if the Social Development Committee is willing to do another inquiry, I suspect. because one of the interesting things, the rationale the Attorney-General gave for the exclusion of those items, when he conducted consultation in 2003, the government, on they issued a discussion paper, they canvassed all the options, and they received 2,000-odd submissions in response to that discussion paper, vast bulk of which were form letters, of course. Let's Get Equal was very active asking people to sign letters, and so were our opponents. And those, what was interesting was that the vast bulk of those opposing the rights were very focused around the parenting stuff, and so the government made a policy or political decision to exclude those matters. I don't think they have taken them off the radar entirely, or at least there's certainly some sympathy in some quarters of the government for the issues to be taken forward again.
Have you got a view about the exception for religious institutions, which the Social Development Committee recommended?
Yes, I do. I personally don't think that the it was necessary. I think the effect of the exemption in the current Equal Opportunity Act was entirely sufficient, and it wouldn't. The reality for religious institutions would be that it wouldn't change at all. However, the effect of so this amendment is a bit of an, to my mind, is an amendment which actually doesn't do very much. It's only a clarifying amendment rather than an actual substantive change. So to that degree, we're not fussed about it. In broader terms, of course, we do have a problem with how the current religious exemptions operate in South Australian Equal Opportunity Law. Those issues we've taken up as part of the consultation the government undertook on equal opportunity reform in its last term. My understanding is that they are going to be bringing a bill forward in the coming session to implement changes in accordance with that equal opportunity discussion consultation that they undertook previously. The question of religious exemptions obviously be one which they will be looking at. Personally, I go for what the Tasmanian Act just doesn't have one, right? And it's up for an organisation has to apply for one.
Yep.
I think that's how it should be with those kind of exemptions. However, if it wasn't possible to move down that path, there is at least a middle course, which is that a religious institution should only be able to claim an exemption for the religious functions, not for any other function. So, in an aged care home that's run by a religious organisation, I think it's absolutely obscene to be able to claim that, you can sack a nurse or a carer if they were gay or lesbian because it doesn't accord with the precept of religion, or a teacher. Well, I heard an interesting story, actually, a church office. I can't remember the name of the woman who this involved, but a church office here in South Australia sat a lesbian, she was an admin assistant. They sat there. Now, I'm sorry, but I really struggle to find how the secretarial work constitutes some kind of religious practice. I just struggle to find that. The other part of it, too, though, is that you can offer this religious exemption and you could require, so you could have that a limited religious exemption closely confined to religious activities, and you could also require that those religious organisations intending to avail themselves of this have to notify the commission, the Equal Opportunity Commission, something like that.
Yep.
So they actually have to take an active step, but it's not the same as actually applying for an exemption before the Equal Opportunity Tribunal. That's probably a halfway sort of house, I suspect, and it would be better than the existing provisions.
Can I ask you what the Let's Get Equal position is regarding domestic codependence?
Yes. We have always been happy for a broader range of relationships to be subject to or have the opportunity to be recognised in the law, and we think that in a sense it's about reopening how we recognise and why we recognise relationships in our law. Having said that, though, arguments that were put forward in the last parliamentary session by people intent upon this issue were, I think, a smokescreen for homophobia and for opposition to the bill. I don't think that they were actually put based upon any sound empirical research or any real demand in the community necessarily. Put it this way, the Carers Association, which you would think is an organisation that would have an interest in this topic, because carers are clearly a category which could be covered by domestic codependent arrangement, They were invited to make a submission to the Social Development Committee inquiry, which was considering this issue of domestic codependence. And the chair of the committee invited them to come along because one of the committee members was quite intent that this issue had to be considered as part of the inquiry's terms of reference. Carers Association said we don't care actually, we don't want to come. They refused to make a submission. They didn't even make a written submission. That suggests to me that there is not a high demand. Another example is that in Tasmania, the registration scheme in Tasmania, we know, allows domestic codependents, I think they call them domestic partners there, or caring relationships, allows them to register and gain the same rights as a consequence of registration as de facto and married partners, with the exclusion of one or two bits and pieces. Now, at the end of the, I think it was the first year of operation of the relationships register in Tasmania, you had something like 50 same-sex partners had been registered, something like 6 or 7 heterosexual de facto partners, and or couples, I should say, and there were no domestic partners. Now, again, interesting one. In New South Wales, and again, I think this is referred to in the Social Development Committee report, the New South Wales Law Reform Commission had done a review of their legislation, and they included a provision for domestic partners in some of their laws. They haven't had any cases come up about that. They have had cases about the de facto stuff come up, one or two, I think. So there's some indications about whether there's a demand. Having said that, in principle, it's not a problem. The other aspect, too, I should say, is that I don't see giving domestic codependence as an issue which would downgrade the status of same-sex partners as de factos. And one of the arguments... and this comes down to the niceties of how people draft amendments, of course. One of the amendments which was put in the Parliament last time would have removed same-sex partners from the de facto category and put them in the domestic codependent category. Mm-hmm. And that actually changes the treatment. And I don't think justifiably so, because I think de facto partners, but same-sex partners are much more aligned with de factos than they are with domestic codependents. And, for instance, one of the clear issues with domestic codependents is how do you draw the boundary? Right? There isn't a lot of case law on it. There's a lot more case law in de facto relationships, as we know. So there's not a real precedent for how do you determine it. And so the classic example, which I think the chair of the Social Development Committee put to everyone who came in, was, well, what if I was sharing a house with someone? And she had shared a house with someone for 4 years or something like that. Does that mean I should be picked up as a domestic codependent and therefore the person I was sharing the house with should have entitlement to this, that and the other? And the answer is obviously no. So you've got to find some way to have a mechanism to filter out people who don't want to. And the way that Tasmania did it was registration. So they don't have a presumptive scheme for domestic codependence. The way New South Wales did it is they confined it to specific acts, not the not all the legislation, but to specific acts where they thought it was relevant. Same in Victoria, I think. I know Victoria didn't do it, sorry. And the way it was ultimately came out in the amendments that were moved to the bill in the upper house last year was this idea of a relationship agreement. And as I said, though, one of the interesting things about that is the definition of domestic codependent. I suspect any de facto partner would potentially meet that definition, therefore be able to avail themselves of a relationship agreement. So it's a kind of a backdoor registration of a sort.
Is the relationship agreement the same thing which is somewhere certified domestic property agreement?
It's current law in South Australia. The De Facto Relationships Act, which governs property division, has got a provision in it for cohabitation agreements, which if they are legally certified can then be binding. So they're basically, it's a statutory scheme for prenups, if you like. And in developing the amendments to recognise domestic codependence, Michelle Lensink, who was the member in the upper house who moved them, thought that was a convenient way to a convenient precedent to use. And so what she said was, a domestic codependent, if they have entered into a domestic relationships property agreement, have all the rights that flow from all they have their property rights, but everywhere else they're mentioned, they're then recognised as a domestic codependent. But if they haven't entered into one of those agreements, they don't get the rest. They don't get anything. Mm. So it's I mean, it was a little bit of it was attack on in some ways. It's probably, I mean, I think the best way to do it is actually to have a clear and transparent registration scheme myself, rather than have the complexity of, you know, is this agreement still legal, or was it, you know, has it fallen into abeyance, all of that kind of stuff that you always have when you have private legal documentation. So I think it would be better to do it by registration scheme. However, it's still quite a, you know, the mechanism she's put forward and that was carried last year is quite acceptable.
Thank you. Matthew, thank you very much for all of that. That's a very interesting discussion. Time's running away from us a bit. So.
No, not at all, I understand.
Thank you very much. We're going to